Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
I'd made mistakes in 95 by getting embroiled in the game of talking about the battle between me and Michael, and the press had made great capital out of all of this rivalry.
Barn Hill hits Schumacher and they both go off! Schumacher running up to the Williams. Now, is he going to have words with Damon Hill?
Michael was very good at rubbing my nose in it, and it was damaging to me and the way that my team thought of me. Nobody wants to think that their guy's a loser. Going into 96, the mission was clear, and I had the tools to rectify the catastrophe of 95.
And Damon Hill wins the Japanese Grand Prix, and I've got to stop because I've got a lump in my throat.
I had a lump in my throat as well.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's F1 Beyond the Grid. I am delighted to say we're joined by the 1996 world champion, Damon Hill. Damon, how are you? Lovely to see you.
I'm very well. Yes, it's lovely to be here, Tom. Thank you for having me again. This is my second.
Yeah.
And do you need to wait 30 years before you get asked back again? Or it actually wasn't 30 years ago, was it? It was 9 years ago?
I think you look about 7 years older than when we last did this. Yep.
That's good, I think.
Yeah. Look, we're speaking at the Hungaroring. I want to talk to you about the world title, obviously, 30 years ago. But we're in Hungary, and I feel it's a very special racetrack for you. You won your first Grand Prix here. You nearly won in the Arrows in 97.
Yeah.
Love this place.
I did win 95 as well. I think I won two.
Yeah. You have? Yeah.
I was trying to work out why I didn't win when I won the championship that year, but I was on the right-hand side of the grid. I qualified second, I think.
Dirty
side of the grid. So the famous right-hand side of the grid did for me on 96.
Yeah.
But I should have been on pole, what can I say?
But my question to you is one that I know Juan Pablo Montoya put to you a few years back as well, which is, you never karted.
No.
This is a grown-up kart track. Why were you always so good at the Hungaroring?
I think, first of all, I had quite a good car advantage, but actually, when I shouldn't really detract from my own performances, but Alan Prost was on the front row and had out-qualified me, but then stalled on the warm-up lap. So he was out. So in 93, I didn't really have any competition. And in actual fact, I can remember the guy who was in second place, it might have been Patrese, was ahead of me. I could see him and he was second. So I'd lapped everyone up to almost second place. I don't know if that's a record. Is anyone must have lapped everyone in the field. If I'd got him, I would have lapped everyone. And then I'd have to lap myself to improve.
But listen, why so quick? Okay, you had the car advantage in 93, fair.
Yeah.
But why so quick here?
So there's two types of corners. It's very simple. This is, all right, so everyone listen, right? This is the fundamentals of racetracks. There's two types of corners. There's 90 degree corners and there's 180 degree corners, give or take, yeah? There's fast corners and slow corners. So this has got lots of 180 degree corners. In fact, one, two, three, I'm counting in my head, four, five substantial corners. And you're in those corners a long time. So if a car doesn't go round a 180 degree corner well, then it's going to be difficult to drive it. So you have to prescribe the curve. You have to try to make the car use all the track it can. And I think maybe motorcycling helped me there a little bit, because on a motorbike, you have to shallow out the curve. You can't really adjust much once you're in the corner. You draw a line in your mind around the corner.
Look, how fascinating to hear you mention motorbikes, because you've won two titles
in your life, the 1984 champion of Brands motorcycle.
The one they all want to win.
Yeah, exactly. That one. And of course, the 1996 Formula One World Championship. What did you learn on bikes? I think you've just touched on it, but what did you learn on bikes that helped you in Formula One?
I think the only thing you can say is that you're on the same racetracks as cars use. You know, so you're the idea of coming into a corner and having to reduce speed in order to get around the corner without reducing the speed too much is the same skill in a car or in a bike. The only thing in a bike is you can fall off. You know, you don't get much of a chance. If you get it wrong on a bike going into the apex, you're usually in big trouble. So in a car, you can afford to slide a bit here and there, but we know that sliding costs you time. So the goal is to get the car to take lateral load in a balanced way, which I think racing bikes, if you race a bike in the wet, you're very conscious of application of brakes, coming off the brakes, that transition bit, and also coming onto the throttle on the way out of a corner. You want to put in as much throttle as you can, torque as you can on the rear wheel, but of course too much and it's very quickly snaps off.
So is it a coincidence that some of your best races in Formula One were in the wet? I'm thinking Suzuka 94 and, of course, you know, that great win for Eddie Jordan at Spa in 98.
Yeah, I think quite a lot of my races were good in the wet. I mean, I remember winning a race in Thruxton. It was absolutely, it had tipped down completely and in Formula 3, and I just got out in front and I was able to, it was like riding a bike in the wet, you know, where you have to, the hairs on the back of your hand stand up, you know, you have to be ready to catch it at any given moment. So I did do well in a lot of the races in Sao Paulo in 96. It absolutely tipped down. I was on the front row, which helps. You could see where you're going, but you're the first person to arrive when there's a puddle or a river.
Well, let's talk about your year of years now, 30 years ago, 1996. Can you put us into your head? What you were thinking, winter 95, 96, because it had been a tough one in 95, hadn't it? Schumacher had won in the Benetton. Just how did you turn things around in the space of one winter?
So if I can ask younger fans to think about how Lewis was last year, it's very depressing when you've been beaten and you're not getting the results you want. It can be quite a downer. So I was pretty down after 95 because I basically had my backside whipped by Michael Schumacher and my nose rubbed in it and all the rest of it. And I didn't like it. You know, it was humiliating. I really thought 95, from 94, having come close to winning the title, I thought 95, this is it. I'm going to come a close second. But unfortunately, he did for me in 95. And I emotionally, psychologically had a big dent. So over the winter, I knew that I had 96 as a great opportunity to maybe win a title. So I had to get myself together. And one of the ways you do that is you have to let go of whatever has passed. And of course, hope springs eternal. And if you've got a car that is going to be good and got a chance of winning, then that's all you think about. You start to think about the future. You start thinking about what's to come. But if you've got a weakness, if you've got a flaw, you need to address that. And so I had to get my head around why I didn't have the right stuff that everyone was talking about Michael Schumacher as having. He just won his second title and clearly he was something special. And I just thought, I don't like that. I don't like the fact that I don't have that special thing. What is that special thing? How do you get it? And can someone like me also have that special thing?
What did you conclude? What was his special thing that you wanted?
I think in truth, you know, he was 10 years younger than me for one thing, and he started his life on a go-kart track. So I think that helped a lot. You were talking to me about not having done karting. That was a weakness for me. I hadn't grown up in the same environment and also in the racing world, the car racing, four-wheel racing world. And I think that my combative skills in cars were not as full and as complete as Michael's was. So I had a little bit of a hole there in my CV. But one of the things, the mental thing, was to understand that when you're fighting for a world championship, you are also involved in a political and psychological battle. And I had allowed the psychological, political battle I'd made mistakes in 95 by getting embroiled in the game of talking about, you know, the competition and the battle between me and Michael, and the press had made great capital out of all of this rivalry, and I'd fallen prey to it. I hadn't got the skills. Michael was very good at rubbing my nose in it, and it was damaging to me and also to the way that my team thought of me. Nobody wants to think that their guy's a loser. And so I had to address that, and I had to come back into 96 with the right attitude and understand that the way I behaved affected the team, and I hadn't really properly appreciated it. And the great drivers understand how to get the team behind you and around them to help them succeed. And I, one of those skills, I think it was because I'd spent so long on my own battling my own career to get to Formula One. I didn't have a team to speak of. And Williams actually were the first real team that I had spent any amount of time with and been through all the battles with. You know, you think about Imola and so forth, you know, and I hadn't prepared myself for that responsibility. And so I think I was just learning those skills, but then I was late in the day. I was 35 years old, and, you know, I didn't have many years ahead of me, not like Michael, who was only 25.
Do you think it felt like you were making these mistakes in a very public environment, weren't you?
Yeah, it is public. I mean, that is the nature of this sport. And it's more public now than ever before. Just everything you do and say is broadcast. Your private, what we would regard as private conversations between yourself and your engineer are broadcast to everyone. And,
wait, Damon, it's an interesting point. If social media had been around in your day, do you think you would have used that to your advantage, or do you think it would have made the situation even worse in 95?
I think if you look at what the contemporary drivers are doing now, they do not get involved in social media for their own advantage. They use it to show pictures of themselves doing R&R. You know, here's me on a boat skiing, or, you know, enjoying myself. All positive stuff. But they don't use it to
get at their rivals.
Yeah, because they know that it backfires. And I think that's a very good example, because that's sort of what I did in 95 with Michael. I played to the press thinking it was a good, fun game, and actually it bit me on the backside.
You know, well, there's that great photograph, isn't there, of you flicking a V at Michael, I think, from the pit wall at Silverstone.
Yeah, which was all done in good humour. But, of course, if you don't understand humour, then it's not
British
funny.
British humour.
No, but it was just, that's the way I saw it, is this is, you know, motor racing was fun, but it's not fun when you're losing. And also, you've got legions of fans who want you to win and you're disappointing them and stuff. It can be really hard.
So you were aware of the flaws in 95, right? Mm. How do you turn that around ahead of 96? Was it just, did someone point it out to you, or were you...
I know what you're doing. You're fishing for the answer. I'm going to give you the answer. Don't worry, Tom. Which was, there was a woman that I got on board, and she'd been used in an interview or a piece that the BBC did about Michael Schumacher and why was he so good. And they did a piece on body language. And I remember it distinctly. There was this woman they got involved who was an advisor to politicians and an image consultant. And her name was Mary Spillane. And she'd been in this piece. So Murray Walker says, what is it about Michael? And she says, well, look at the way he walks. For instance, you know, he's got his chin up and his head up and he's striding through. He's very confident. You look at Damon, he's looking at his shoelaces and shuffling around the paddock looking like he's beaten already. And I just thought, what? You mean it's as simple as that? You know, you're judging me on the way I'm walking in the paddock. That was an insight that I hadn't really considered. I'd never really thought that this is going to have a part to play. But of course it does. It does. Body language is very interesting, because actually you can improve your confidence by adopting the posture. It's not the chicken or the egg. You know, it's you might say, okay, well, this person is, he's not confident because he's looking down at his shoes and stuff. That tells us he's not confident. Whereas you can actually go, okay, now do what Michael does. Walk in with your chest out and your chin up and look confident. And actually the confidence builds in you. So the psychology, you can, there's a thing called the inner smile in Buddhism, where you meditate and you think of things that make you smile, and it increases. And so they can show this now medically, they can show it scientifically, that your, the endorphins and all the things that make you feel good start to come into play, even if you fake a smile.
So did you start meditating?
No, I've tried meditating, mate, honestly. It's not easy. Sitting down for lengthy time, periods of time, not thinking about anything is quite hard. On that subject, there's two ways to meditate. There's open attention and closed attention. And so you can actually be meditating when you're driving a racing car. There's a great quote from Stirling Moss, which is, speed is tranquility.
Is this the flow state?
That's sort of what it is. So you get to the point where you're not conscious. You're not consciously doing something. You are aware of yourself doing something, which is your consciousness, but you're not actually engaging. So these things are states of mind where, so getting back to your point, I had to learn certain skills in order to go into a championship year that would arm me. It would provide me with an armor, and it would also help me concentrate on what it was I was there to do. In other words, don't get involved in stuff that you have no control over. There's going to be stuff in your life, all of our lives, that we have no control over, or very little control. You know, I mean, if a butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon can cause a tornado in Tokyo, then, you know, everything has an effect, but it's minimal. And the point is, only focus on what you can have a definite impact on and stuff like that. So going into 96, the mission was clear, and I had the tools that I needed in order to rectify the catastrophe of 95.
That's a strong word. Catastrophe, is that?
Yeah, I think it was close to catastrophe. And I think I was not retained by Williams in 90, at the end of my 96 season. And I think the damage was done in 95. So I think that probably was when a deal was done to not extend my contract. They knew that I was going to be there for 96, but I'm not sure that they thought that they were completely convinced that I was going to do the job and maybe Jack would win the championship, which he, you know, he put up a good fight and he could have done.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. AI is changing the way businesses work at an incredible pace. But as quickly as those new tools and opportunities are appearing, there's something else growing alongside them. AI risk. And that's where Vanta can help. Vanta is the number one agentic trust platform already used by more than 16,000 fast-moving companies. It helps businesses keep an eye on the risks that can appear between audits across their vendors, AI tools, and wider environment. And I think what's really smart is how the Vanta agent works away in the background, a bit like having a 24/7 GRC engineer, finding issues and even drafting fixes for you. It can also cut the time spent assessing vendors by up to 50%. So rather than waiting for the next audit to find out something needs your attention, Vanta is designed to help you stay on top of things as your business and the technology around it keeps moving. Whether you're a fast-growing startup or a global enterprise, Vanta is here to help you automate your security and compliance and earn and prove trust. Get started today at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid.
Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Can we talk about the car now, the FW18? From the first moment you turned a wheel in it, did you know you had the car underneath you as well?
It's amazing, isn't it? Out of the box, that's what they say. You know, if it feels
within
good,
five laps.
Yeah, it's amazing. It just did everything you wanted it to do. The 95 car was good, but this one was just sufficiently incrementally better so that it was
everywhere.
In response. Yeah, you felt completely confident in it. If you made a little mistake, you could correct it and get away with it. So you're able to relax a bit in your driving and explore the limits of the car.
And how closely had you worked with Adrian Newey, the car's designer, during its sort of gestation?
Well, listen, I didn't go into the winter. I didn't go up to his drawing office and go, ah, I see you've got the front wings on the front of the car. But, have you tried putting them somewhere else? But, no, I mean, you know, what use am I to Adrian Newey?
Except, yeah. Did you ask him to make it big enough for your size 11s?
I did. The only thing, this is the thing about the car is, and I got in at Goodwood recently, and I must have changed shape a little bit. I think my hips were crushed, but from years of being in a cockpit. So my hips are slightly wider, but it's up against the bone, so it can't be. It's not podge. it was a bit snug, but principally the car fitted me. But it was slightly snugger than I remember. But my feet were able to operate the pedals, and there were cars I drove. Because I got wide feet, so I've got they're size 11, which for a racing driver is big, but they're wide. So the problem is the narrowness of the cockpit. They don't leave much room for you to get your foot. In those days, we used foot clutch as well, so there wasn't the two pedal thing. That would have been a solution for me, but so getting your feet between the bloody pedals and not hitting the brake with the accelerator when you're braking and stuff was always very difficult. So Adrian said, we've got to make you fit. And I remember Patrick and Adrian coming down and says, Patrick going, right, we've got to get him fit into the car. That's like, that's a good thing to think about, isn't it? Because you have to have a driver in it. Have you ever thought of that?
But again, back to the confidence thing, just having, a footwell that fits,
yeah,
that all builds confidence, right?
Yeah. So it was a bespoke car. That's the way I would describe it. It was a Damon Hill bespoke car. Jacques didn't have the same height and size of feet problems as I had, so he had plenty of room to play with. But it was important to get me fit. And also the other thing was the height of your head was really critical because if you look at that car, the helmet and the headrest are designed almost as they're one piece. If I was too high, it would affect the airflow into the airbox, which was really significant. So
were you lying down more?
I was lying down a bit more, yeah. But snug, in the car, I fitted that car to perfection. So no, it was good.
You mentioned Villeneuve, your new teammate for 96. I remember quite a song and dance about him coming over from IndyCar, and there'd been the big test.
Indianapolis 500 and the Indy, he was a big shot.
Well, and I remember the test at Silverstone midway through 95, it's the do or die test. Is he going to come? Isn't he? What did you make of him, both as a driver and as a personality?
I liked him. I liked his, he was quirky. Was he 25 and I was 35? So I think he was 10 years younger than me, maybe 9. Yep. So he's a younger person and liked to do things his own way and quite quirky in that way. I mean, he used to clean his teeth in the debrief room, stuff like that.
Mid-debrief?
Yeah, so the thing is with Jacques is if he does something different and he gets a reaction out of people, he's happy because he wants to be different. So he doesn't have a belt on his overalls and they look like they're about to fall off and stuff. But he liked that because everyone around would be reacting to his difference and his spiky hair and the various things.
And the blonde hair. And
all that. So, yeah, he made sure that it was clear. The message from him was, I'm going to do it my way, which he certainly did.
And did that sit well with Williams? Because from the outside looking in, back then at least, Williams was quite a traditional team. Frank,
yeah, they were
Patrick.
They were making a lot of accommodations for him. And I remember feeling a little bit annoyed at that because when I had been there for that amount of time, I had been a good boy and I'd done what they told me, but then I'd started as a test driver. I hadn't insisted on things perhaps in the way I should have done. Now I was a little bit more established and more mature and they'd already indicated to me that they expected me to get the championship for them up against someone who was an unknown quantity. So I was a little bit more relaxed that year, but it was funny watching, Jacques with his curious quirkiness. Because Patrick is a very, what shall we say, conservative person. And you could see he wanted to say something, but he bit his lip and let Jacques get on with it.
There were a few sporting changes as well coming into the new season. I think perhaps the most visible was that the five red lights that we have now were first introduced in 96.
Were they?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. How
there was a race where they'd never they didn't change, or something happened. Do you remember they were supposed to go out? Is that why they changed them? Because it was a green light was supposed to come on. I think the red lights went out and the green light didn't come on or something. No, we didn't.
Yeah. Do we go? Do. Don't we?
Yeah,
go.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. They fixed that.
But
so.
Was it? I mean, difficult to get your head around? No, I'm guessing you just
what the five lights thing.
Yeah.
No, these things are not important, Tom. Honestly, you know, a signal to go is useful as long as we get that.
Then, well, then you had two.
But
starts.
Don't forget, they used to literally a guy would wave a flag. He'd drop the flag, and all the drivers would work out with each starter's. You know, quirkiness, and there'll be certain flag people who would indicate that they were going to drop it by something. They scratched their nose or something, and everyone knew, so everyone would start before the bloke had even dropped it.
I don't remember many penalties back then for jumping the start, anyway, right?
No, it was very random.
Yeah. But you had two starts actually in Melbourne, first race, didn't you? Because there was, of course, the big crash. Yeah, there was the big crash on lap one, wasn't there, with Martin Brundle?
Yes.
So you had two goes at it. Look, talk us through that Melbourne weekend. You and Jacques in pre-season testing, it was clear that you guys were maybe not a two-horse race for the title, but Williams were going to be the most competitive car. You know, like two boxes just sort of dancing around each other. Round one, Jacques goes and puts it on pole. That wasn't in the script, was it?
No, it wasn't. But it wasn't entirely unexpected. You know, I think that he was, he came in at an attacking level of competitiveness. You know, the points are given out when you cross the line at the end of the race. But yeah, I think I let him have a little bit of an advantage that I shouldn't have done perhaps then. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, I don't remember doing an absolutely banzai qualifying lap in Melbourne. I don't know why, but
but why wouldn't, I mean, like,
yeah,
full sense of security. Is this,
yeah,
you
maybe
sort of,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I do remember during the race that it was quite easy to stick on his tail. And sure enough, an opportunity arose at that point. But
well, mind you, you were covered in oil for most of that race, weren't you? How difficult is it when you can't see where you're going?
Well, the only encouraging thing was I knew that eventually his oil would run out. So I thought he can't keep puking oil out forever. But he had been on the grass a few times. And well, the way I looked at Jack was he was right on the edge and I wasn't. So, you know, the goal is to win at the slowest possible speed.
And you go on and win four of the opening five races, right? At that point, what were you thinking? I've got this.
I knew that there's going to be a point in the season where, I mean, that advantage is really important to get. If you've got, there's going to be a time when Jack settles in and learns things and he goes to circuits that he's had some experience of and stuff. So I was going to lose that edge to him. He's going to come strong as the season went on, or there's going to be some blip somewhere. And I was absolutely right. There always is in a championship season. Even though we only did 16 races back then, there's always a bit in the middle where the wheels come off, literally and metaphorically, in someone's championship. And you have to dig deep in those moments and put the car back on track before the end.
I think there are three stages to your championship year. The dominant start, after the struggles in 95, just how sweet was it to be on that winning streak? Not only winning the races on Sunday, but actually Melbourne aside, knocking out the pole positions as well. It's the first time you'd had that sort of been on that wave, wasn't it?
Well, I started every race on the front row, and I think that's still a record. I don't know. But so it was pretty consistent in qualifying, and I'd got my qualifying performances down to a T, really, and try and go out dead last. And, you know, when you go out the garage, you go out sort of 2.5 minutes to go because you'd worked out that when you cross the line, all that stuff, you know, it was all going to plan on the qualifying stakes. And Dario Franchitti pointed out to me something which I'd forgotten about, which was he said, your qualifying lap in the Nürburgring was really good. And actually, I'd forgotten about that one because that was a very unusual track because it's got a lot of banked corners. But oh my God, that lap was almost perfect. And it was such a thrill to do it, you know, in the car that was doing what you wanted it to do.
Do you feel untouchable in those moments? Do you almost wish that Michael Schumacher was back in a Benetton and could actually...
I was quite glad to see him where he was. No, I mean, I still regard racing against Michael and and Suzuka as being the peak of whatever I could pull out of myself. And so you want to be up against the very best to find out what you're capable of. But I have to say, you know, that those guys like Michael are able to perform at such a high level for their whole career. You know, they are constant, super quick drivers. It wears you down. You know, as a mere mortal, I couldn't do that. I could do it, you know, maybe if I'd started karting earlier, maybe if I'd had more confidence in myself, I could have been up there. But when 96 happened, yes, I was confident. I pretty much knew I could beat Jack. There were occasions when Jack was quicker than me and prepared to do things, but then he was always on the back foot trying to catch me up. So he had to take more risks. And, Jack is the sort of person who does take a lot of risks to get results. Whereas the way I looked at it was, I'm never going to get another chance again. I cannot afford to put this in the wall and then and miss a couple of races because I got a concussion or something. And I remember Nigel, you know, eliminating himself from a championship or two by having a big shunt and not being able to finish it off. So I was aware that there's a pitfall there somewhere. And it's like playing cards. You have to know when to play your ace card. You know, if you've got an ace in your hand, you don't put it down, you know, at the first game. You've got to know when to play it.
Yeah. Well, look, back to the different stages then. Dominate the early season. And then you said that the wheels in every championship come off literally and metaphorically. Let's talk Silverstone, right?
I thought you were going to talk about Monza, but
we'll get to Monza. Let's do this in chronological order, right? But, you know, you go to Silverstone, home race. There was so much hype around you then. How much of a kick in the stomach was it to end up in the gravel at Copse?
Yeah, it was.
It was a wheel nut, I think.
Very unusual. It was a wheel bearing failure, I think. Mechanical failure, unusual. Does happen from time to time. But so, yeah, I think I could have won that one. You know, so there was a few British Grand Prix I'd nearly won. I mean, the 93, I nearly won it. And then I had an engine block. Then there was one where I kind of brought defeat on myself by colliding with Michael. I really should have won that one. But anyway.
Well, and then there was Monaco as well, you know, which you were leading, dominating.
Damon Hill out of the Monaco Grand Prix. He was destined not to win this race. And my goodness, the Englishman's heart will be plunging to his boots. Flames out of the back of the engine and Damon walks away. Oh, look, you can see the anguish as he clenches his fist to his helmet.
That was a great weekend for Williams because we actually got the pit stop time to perfection, which was a new thing for us. And it was, you know, it was just the perfect time to change tyres and go on to slicks. And I was very comfortably in the lead, but the Renault, unfortunately, had a little bit of a problem.
But
with
those failures, the new version
those are the
of
things
Damon Hill.
You've got to factor them in. You've got to factor them in. At the start of the season, you're not going to win everything. That's totally unrealistic. You've got to put down three races, maybe to mechanical failures, two at least, and then maybe two to your own stupid fault. So that's four races, you know?
So a Monaco, a Silverstone didn't upset you. You just put them behind you, move on
what
to the
can
next
you do?
Race.
You know, they're gone. Yeah. That's it. That's in the bag. That's part of the deal. So you just go to the next race and make sure you're prepared for the next one.
This episode is sponsored by CarGurus. When you're thinking about buying a new car, you don't always know exactly what you're looking for, do you? You might know what you need from it, plenty of space, something good for a long commute, maybe a car that works for the whole family, but not necessarily which make or model ticks those boxes. And that's where I think CarGurus Discover feature is really useful. Instead of having to know exactly what to search for, you can just describe what you need in your own words. So you could ask for something like reliable family car with plenty of space. And Discover instantly shows you real available cars based on what you actually need. Then, once you've found something you like, CarGurus gives you all the important details up front as well. You can see complete specs, vehicle history, price changes, and verified dealer reviews. So it's much easier to compare your options and work out what's right for you. You can even set up real-time alerts for price drops and new listings, so if the right car does come along, you're less likely to miss it.
Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's cargurus.co.uk. cargurus.co.uk. CarGurus. Search. Buy. Sorted.
Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Monza then. Frank gave you the bad news in the lead up to that race that you weren't going to be retained by the team.
There were rumours. Don't forget there was...
In Hungary, there were rumours. It was leaked in Germany.
That
was it Germany?
The Autosport piece by Andrew Benson, where he was front page of Autosport, was Damon's not staying at Williams next year. And I thought this was just newspaper sensationalism, just trying to create a story. So I was a bit annoyed to have him report this, but he was right.
But did you confront Frank Williams about that story?
I think Patrick, I had some words with Patrick, but I don't remember too much about that. I just put it down to conjecture. And I always worked on, okay, let's say Frank had actually made plans not to have me. Then if I won the championship, perhaps that he'd change his mind. That was my logic. It doesn't matter which way you look at it. Even if I am leaving, I've still got to win the championship. So it was a distraction. Do you remember I mentioned things that you can do and you can't do anything about? What can you affect? You can only affect your own environment and your own things that are within your command. And so it was always the right thing to do to just put that to one side and to concentrate on winning the championship.
But what about the mechanics on your side of the car, right? Do they not in Germany go, Damon, have you seen the story in Autosport?
I never asked them. I think we all just got on with our job of, and.
But you did get the bad news officially.
Yeah.
In the lead up to Monza.
Yeah. So Frank phoned me, I was in Ireland, and he phoned me up and said, just to let you know, I'm not going to be, you know, keeping on for next year. I've got to do what's right for the team, is what he said. I don't know if that was supposed to make me feel better or what, or soften the blow, but.
Did you ask any questions? Why or just...
No, what, I just said, yeah, because I sort of knew, what's the point? He's the boss. It's his team. Okay, Frank. Yeah, gotcha.
But do you think there's a link between that telephone conversation and the fact that you were leading at Monza and then clip a tire?
No, the reason I clipped the tire was entirely the same sort of mistake that Ayrton made in Monaco, is I backed off. I was going...
It was very early in the race.
Yeah, it wasn't. Okay, his was later in the race, but the fact that remains that I was going like a bat out of hell. And I did a great move on John Lacey going into the second Lesmo to get through to the lead. And I looked in my mirrors and thinking, okay, calm it down a bit, Hill. And I'd been going through that chicane beautifully up to that point where I'd literally been throwing it in and then just flicking it through. And... I went, okay, just knock it back a notch. Anyway, so I threw it at the corner and it didn't slide. It gripped and turned in too soon. And I clobbered the bloody tire, took my wheel off. And then I thought, oh, now what have you done? And so I was greatly relieved to see Mick Hakkinen do the same thing a couple of years later.
Of course he did. Yeah. But how much of a distraction at
I'm in
a
good
crucial...
company. Thank you, Mika.
Yes. At a crucial point in the season, suddenly you've got to get yourself... a drive for next year. Did you...
Well,
any...
I mean, actually, we should mention in that race, I think Jacques had a mechanical failure, didn't he? He didn't finish. So he could have closed the gap massively to me in Monza, and it didn't happen. So it's like, that was a bit of an escape.
But in terms of finding yourself a ride for the following season...
Yeah, so then the moment I... We did the last, so I had to do some phoning to try and find
out... Were
that.
You doing the phoning, or did you have a manager back then?
I had a lawyer... guy who was the contact,
Michael Breen.
And so we had discussions about what the options were. And one of the options
just to take it back a notch, I assume he'd had conversations with Frank about 97.
Yeah, you can assume that. I think he did have conversations. I wasn't privy to what the conversations actually said.
I mean, do you think there was like, was he asking for too much money? Or do you think is there any reason like that?
Possibly, but that then it's always open. My phone's always, on. So Frank could have phoned me and said, he's asking for too much money. What can we do about it?
And he didn't.
If that was the case.
Yeah.
But there was no conversation.
So you're winning the world championship. Yeah. You know you're not staying with your team for the following year. Who's the first person you ring?
Don't forget there was Paul Stewart Racing. There was Jackie's team, Paul Stewart's team. They were coming in. They were going to do their first year in... Or was that the year after? Maybe that was the year after.
97 was their first year, yeah.
So 97. And I just thought, I can't go for a team that's not done anything at all. So that was one of the options.
It was Jackie Stewart, friend of your father.
Hugely emotionally, yeah. It was.
Were you tempted?
I was very tempted, yeah, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I just thought, the old thing about never do business with friends,
kind of thing.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And I just thought this is going to be complicated, and I had to say no, and it broke my heart to say no to Jackie because I just, I didn't want to do it, and Paul as well, because there's a closeness there through my dad to them, and so I would have loved to have gone there with and put a spring in their step, but I just had to be in a position. The bottom line was Adrian was going to leave Williams and go to McLaren, but he'd have a year off, so. My whole ambition was to get to McLaren.
For 98.
To drive the Adrian Newey McLaren. And that was always the ambition. So I needed a one-year deal. And the other deals that were on the table were more than one year.
So that's why you went to Arrows?
Yeah, Arrows. Tom just said, okay, I'll give you a one-year deal. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then it didn't work.
And how close did the McLaren thing get?
It got to the point where Ron gave me an offer I had to refuse.
So he made you an offer?
Yeah, it was a ridiculous offer. It was the kind of offer that was, he has a certain way about him. And Adrian had put in a little bit of a good word, but I think that Ron, frankly, knew what his team and driver lineup was, and he liked Mika and he liked David and he wanted to keep it that way. And so I think I was, rather than saying we're not interested, he sort of said, well, I'll pay you if you win, So that was the deal. The offer was, I'd only get paid if I won.
Well, you'd have you'd have earned quite a lot of money in 98.
I would have done, but I think the fact that you're not getting any value of yourself as a person in the team recognized was, I think, designed to make me cheesed off. So I said thanks for the offer and see you next year.
And then was Eddie Jordan in the picture at that point, or did that only come later in 97?
Later on, I think, yeah.
Okay. Well, look, back to 96.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward.
I know, by the way, I put everything I said, described about the negotiations with McLaren into my book, and Ron read it. And he said, I just want to say that you're absolutely correct in what you described. In other words, it's been verified by Ron as being entirely accurate.
Available in all good bookshops.
Available in all bookshops. I should have got him to do the forward.
Let's fast forward to Japan, 1996. Final race of the year. You're 9 points ahead of your teammate, 10 points for the win. So you're the hot favourite, but it's not over the line. How were you feeling when you got off the plane in Tokyo?
So I'd basically gone to Hong Kong to get over jet lag. So there's a big gap, 3 weeks gap between Estoril and Japan. And Bernie had expected me to win the championship in Estoril. And I still meet people today who said, we went to Estoril and we spent our hard-earned cash to come and see you win the championship and you didn't win it. But even Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall came. And they had
to Estoril.
Yeah. They were on the grid. So literally about to start the race, and I've got blooming photographers all over my front wings, and I'm going, guys, get, and there's Jerry Hall and Mick Jagger posing for photographs. Anyway, didn't happen there. After Estoril, I had to do testing as well.
I'm surprised they let you test so late in the year, given that you weren't there the following year.
I think I stayed for testing afterwards. Yeah. And then I had to fly back home to do the deal with Arrows. So I had to get a job for next year in between Estoril and the championship. So, but once all that had been done, and I went back to home to Ireland, and I said to Georgie, you never guess what I've just done. And she said, you signed for Arrows. I said, yeah, which seemed like a completely mad thing to do at the time, but they had Bridgestone tyres coming, and I thought there's, you know. Anyway, then I had to go to Hong Kong, because one of the worst things about Japan is the jet lag. And if you don't get there, or don't get on the time zone. So I went to Hong Kong a few days before. Georgie came over to Hong Kong. This was before it had gone back to China. So there was Chris Patton was there. We met him in a restaurant we went to, Mad Dogs, and he was there. And it was the end of the British rule of Hong Kong. And so we had a little bit of a nice break there, getting over jet lag, and then off to do business in Japan.
So you were over the jet lag by the time you rolled
up. Unbelievable thing, isn't it? It still gets you a week later.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. I couldn't sleep anyway. I mean, you know.
Because you were nervous?
Yeah. You can't sleep. Yeah. You know, you've got 24 hours before you know whether you're going to be world champion or not.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to sleep.
When you were in the car, did you feel you were tightening up at all? Did anything feel different?
Do you know what? I did a lot of training as well. In actual fact, I think I overtrained. So I'm in the car and I'm literally going, I haven't got any feeling at all. I was powering the car, and I kind of had to kind of shake myself loose a bit. It plays with your natural balance, I think, when you've got, so that's part of it, is you have to return to the center, if you want to call it that, to make sure that you perform properly.
Now, Villeneuve put in a brilliant pole out. Was that the best version of him that you saw?
I don't remember it.
Too focused on yourself.
Yeah. Listen, it didn't matter to me. I mean, as I said, I saw Nigel in 85 or something. He could win the world championship.
87 when he crashed.
87 Suzuki, crashed. That, yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I knew you'd correct me. Right. But yeah, he was in contention for the world championship, and he put himself out because he smashed into the wall in Suzuka. So my objective was qualify well, no mistakes, and Jack can get pole position if he wants to. The only thing that matters to me is...
I don't even need to win the race.
Yeah. I need to win the championship. That was always the objective, the strategy. So, yeah, there are some people who want to win everything, and you can go Monte Carlo or bust, you know, but I took a measured approach to it, I think. So.
Well, I made the better start and kind of disappeared off.
Yeah.
And he then retires mid-race.
Yeah.
Can you remember how you felt?
It didn't matter because I was ahead of him anyway. So
yeah.
I think I had a 9-point advantage. So yeah. All I had to do, if he won, all I had to do was come ninth, I think.
But even so, when you were told over the radio that Jacques is out, you are the world champion. Can you remember how that felt?
Well, I was still racing. So literally, Jacques out, you're world champion. It was like when you're in a racing mode, you're not emotionally up and down. You're focused on what you're doing. So it was neither one thing or another. It was like, Jack's out, you're world champion. Okay, well, I was probably going to be world champion anyway if it carried on like this. So no difference there. So I thought I'd have a bit of fun with the team. And I said, do you mind if I come in now? I said, we'd prefer it if you carried on, Damon. So I still had about 20 laps to go, I think. I don't remember how many, but so I literally was driving around thinking, okay, how much longer we got?
This is something that many people didn't think could possibly happen today. They thought Damon would drive a cautious race, but he fought. He fought from second on the grid. He passed Jacques Villeneuve. He took the lead. He stayed there. And Damon Hill exits the chicane and wins the Japanese Grand Prix. And I've got to stop because I've got a lump in my throat.
I had a lump in my throat as well. You know, you put a lot of effort into becoming world champion and a lot of investment and lots of emotional ups and downs. And so to have arrived at that point was a huge relief. And also I was looking forward to a getting some sleep as well.
I remember the cameras cutting to Georgie,
yeah,
who was in the garage. Can we say it? I think she had a couple.
No, they'd been celebrating since Jacques Villeneuve's wheel fell off.
Yeah.
So they'd already passed the point of caring.
And I remember the mics picked her up saying, 12 years. 12 years we fought for this.
Yeah?
Yeah. Back, well, from when you made the switch from bikes to cars. So
yeah,
very much a journey you did together.
With whom? With Georgie?
Yeah, with the wife, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, completely. I was already bike racing. And so she was with me through the transition from bikes to cars. And, you know, so, you know, she's come to Brands Hatch with me and all the rest of it. So poor girl. She's had to put up with the whole experience.
Can you remember what Frank and Patrick said to you after the race?
They were very happy. They were happy. But there was no, you know, there was no, sorry, you got to go.
I was wondering if that's what they might have said.
No one really wanted to mention that bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the things I do remember is when I got out of the car, I was very sad to get out of the car because it was my car. That was the car that made me a world champion. And Adrian engineered me throughout the season as well, together with Tim Preston as well. So he gave him a little bit of help. And so I was given all the advantages and a car, great championship winning car, which I'm very lucky to have been reunited with at things like the Goodwood Festival of Speed and did one at Silverstone.
Jacques was on the show a while back and he said he was actually pleased that you won.
He was
very
really
generous.
Great, magnanimous sportsman. And that's what I like, Jack. You know, he was out there to fight hard, but fair. And he came for supper with us at the end, you know, so we celebrated together. And I knew he'd, you know, he'd have his chance the next year. But he gave me a run for my money. You know, he wasn't a pushover. And he was, you know, he was a good guy. And he still is. You know, he's never changed at all. He's a very unique individual, but very charming.
And did winning the title change your life?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I mean, the reason we're having this conversation is because I won a world championship 30 years ago. You know, and so, you know, you occasionally get introduced as a former world champion and I have to correct them and say, no, I was a former Formula One driver, but I'm always a world champion.
And that is a great place to end it. Damon, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes, you're always a world champion. What a conversation. Damon at his very best. So articulate, so disarmingly honest, and so interesting. His Formula One journey resonates with so many people, and the lessons he learned 30 years ago about how to win are still applicable today. The drivers having a difficult time of it right now should listen to Damon. Listen to how he turned things around between 1995 and 96. Damon, many thanks for your time. It was great to chat. Well, that's almost it for this week. Before I go, let's celebrate the fact that F1 returns from the summer break this weekend at Zandvoort. And you can listen to F1 Nation's preview of the Dutch Grand Prix right now. Jolyon Palmer and James Hinchcliffe join me to discuss who's in the race to catch championship leader Kimi Antonelli in the second half of the season. That's out now on the F1 Nation feed. And you can watch us on the F1 YouTube channel. Thanks very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another big name from Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.